Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we try to, how do we say this, deconstruct Ooh. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's most incredible investing strategies that have produced, they've actually produced more millionaires and billionaires than anything I know of, other than starting your own business.
Wow, that sounds like the kind of statistic that's difficult to disprove.
I think that... God, just go with me one of these times. Just go right with me. But no.
Okay, I mean, I think it's great. The more millionaires and billionaires than you know of anything else doing. It's perfect.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have backing me up on that. That's not just me, just some guy. This is backed up by Li Lu, who is one of the most respected investors in the world and has compounded money in the high 20s now for about almost 25 years. And is the only person that Charlie Munger has ever put money with besides he and Buffett managing it. Phenomenal investor. And he said exactly the same thing, that this strategy of investing has produced more success than any other strategy in history. And almost like there's no second place.
I mean, it's got to be right. It's almost like calling it a strategy is a bit silly because it's just, when you get down to it, finding good stuff and you're putting your money to support the good stuff so that it can grow bigger.
Yeah.
And people get all fancy about that. But yeah, it's good.
Exactly. Now, I do have to say, I will soften the blow to all the other strategies of investing out there by saying that Renaissance and that whole crew of literal rocket scientists destroy the rate of return produced by value investors. It's just destroy it. I mean, these guys have ballpark 75% compounded now going on a couple of decades. And they're using their own money. I mean, they've even given back all the investor money. They said, here, take your money back. And people are like, please, no, please keep it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. And so,
I mean, they do that with algorithms.
They do it with algorithms.
And we are going to learn more about that today.
Oh, what?
It's finally here, guys. We've succeeded. We have an expert on the show. So yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off.
You're talking about me. You're talking about me, of course.
I'm always talking about you. We have an expert on the show every week, except for the weeks we don't make it.
But perhaps we're not talking about me today?
Perhaps we're not talking about you. We have a second expert, maybe. And who this person is... Now, you guys know that I have been listening to SmartList.
Now, when you say maybe, do you mean maybe he's an expert or she is an expert, or maybe we have them on and we're not sure?
I was saying maybe we have them on and we're not sure because we have been going through it with our technical and audio situations today.
Oh,
but you guys will find out in a minute why that is. So should I introduce our mystery guest?
I think so. I'm certainly like excited to find out who's here.
Oh, good. I think that you're about to hear some stuff you may not know. So again, in the style of SmartList, where they have mystery guests that come on, I thought I'd introduce this person with a little bit of mystery guest info. So this person is Portuguese and speaks four languages fluently. This person cuts his own hair. This person was are you interrupting my introduction?
Well, I'm just astonished that we tied in those two things in one sentence. Okay, go on. Would you repeat that? What you just said? I thought
this
I must
person
have missed something.
Cuts his own hair.
Yes, and speaks four languages.
He's skilled. This person was a top junior tennis player in his teen years. And then he switched to racing rally cars through the beautiful dirt roads of Portugal. And that rally drifting experience in the dirt then prepared him to race on tarmac now and learn to drift a car on tarmac. He earned the title of Driftmeister. Yes. We have the Driftmeister on the show today. This person loves long-distance cycling and for his 50th birthday climbed Mont Ventoux in the south of France. In the snow, twice in a row, he went down and went back up again. Personally, when I could barely walk right after COVID and was going to a million doctor appointments, this person adjusted his schedule to make sure that he came to pick me up from the hospital after every single one of my appointments so that I could get home. He was on time or early every single time so that I didn't have to wait outside and get even more tired. That's just one of a thousand ways he has taken care of me. This person gets obsessed with eating one type of fruit at a time only. And he eats huge amounts of this fruit every single day. I think we're supporting the fruit industry. And right now it's oranges. And we are out of them currently in the house. And it's fraught. They are being delivered tomorrow. He's eating like 7 or 8 oranges a day. Before the oranges, it was pears. I was glad to move on to oranges. This person has an academic background in economics, but several years ago, he got annoyed that he couldn't run his own algorithms, and he decided to just teach himself how to write his own machine learning code for fun from textbooks. He's a giant nerd, and he fits right in here at Invested as a giant nerd with us. This person is a partner at a global management consulting firm where he is the global head for strategy and artificial intelligence, and where he uses artificial intelligence as a methodological tool in the context of his strategy projects to create insights that wouldn't otherwise be available. Hopefully today he'll give us some pointers on the technical side of artificial intelligence and machine learning, including helping us understand what those are and what innovations are coming along and how we can use them in our investing practices. This person, as I'm sure you all have guessed, has also voluntarily joined our crazy family, Dad, and he loves them madly, which makes me happy because I wouldn't have married him if he didn't. It's my husband, Umyumbireido Maravilloso. That's my terrible Portuguese. Nuno de Cheneves Cordeiro. Nuno!
Nuno!
Hello.
I had a clue. And I would say, honestly, I would be so intimidated from that curriculum vitae rundown that you just did. I would be so intimidated. And if I had half a brain, I would be. But you know how it is with family.
Well, I am intimidated. I feel that everything I say from now on, you know, can only make, you know, everyone's perception go down from that kind of very high standard was set that right there.
To put you on a pedestal.
Oh my gosh. I can only fall.
but you deserve to be there. You are truly one of the most remarkable men I have ever met. And I've been very proud that my daughter married you and that you married her. And I thought, really, you know, I hit the son-in-law lottery.
That's
you came
so nice.
On board. It's just like you just pray that your daughter gets a great husband and, you know, somebody that you can admire and respect. And oh my gosh, I admire and respect
well,
her so much.
And
by the way, the Driftmeister is well earned, I have to say. I was at the track when you got Driftmeister twice.
Oh, twice. I didn't even twice. Put that in twice.
Which is really remarkable how much control you have of an automobile sliding around on ice and dirt. And it's just like, are you kidding me? How do you do that? So anyway, you're a remarkable guy, man.
Right back at you.
And, did you hear that? I'm claiming some of that. That you've accomplished in your life by virtue of being your father-in-law, that does wash over on me a tad. I feel really quite proud of you for that.
and vice versa. And again, right back at you. Very kind introduction. And once again, I can only degrade that image you just created of me by opening my mouth. So
now everyone knows about your orange addiction. So it's actually, it's all up from here. Yeah.
But also, I think everyone can hear just from the few moments we've actually let you speak that you are the most humble person I think I've ever met. And to be that humble with that curriculum vitae and that background is just amazing, man. You never cease to astonish anyone who gets to know you as how humble you are and how deep you go. So hopefully we can ask some questions here today that would challenge you a little bit and would help our audience just understand a little bit more about machine learning and all the work you've done with it and where this thing is going and why some people say it's never going to be anything particularly useful. And they seem to be in the vast minority and everybody else is worried about them taking over the world and killing us all. So yeah, where are we there? So go ahead, Danielle. Yeah, I think you've probably...
I feel like that's the question. I mean, we could just be quiet and he could talk about that question the whole time. So maybe we start with... I mentioned machine learning and I mentioned artificial intelligence. What are those things and are they different?
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, that's an excellent starting question, actually, because AI, in fact, is nothing more than a concept, actually. It's just a reference to any type of, when I say machine, let's call it an agent doing kind of human-like or performing human-like type of tasks. But that's it. That's just a concept. Now, AI can be implemented in two ways. One is rule-based, and many chatbots you would have, you know, had experience with are precisely that, you know, if-then-else type of logic there, which obviously makes for somehow a limited scope of usage. And a second way in which AI can be implemented is through machine learning. And these are a bit more elaborate and sophisticated algorithms that actually learn from data that they are fed and basically can, from that learning, actually generate insights, being in a form of, you know, transparency on specific challenges that a business might be facing, be it in terms of, you know, concrete predictions, which are a bit more like the so what, you know, like, yes, I have an attrition problem now, help me identify clients that I address. So, you know, in a way, AI is rule-based plus machine learning.
So it sounds like the rule-based option is much more simple than the machine learning option. Would that be true?
Yeah, and it's been around for a really, really long time. You know, rule-based type of, let's say you want to, you're looking to automate a very, very simple process. You know, if you observe a certain thing, then, you know, a certain outcome needs to happen. So this has been around now for forever.
Computers.
Well, computers are the vehicle through which these things get, you know, eventually implemented. Yeah. But it's a process. If you think of it as a bit of a filtering process in which you take an input and then based on what you observe on that input, you have a predetermined output that you need to generate.
So ChatGPT and now Bard are both examples of machine learning algorithms that are, you know, trying to generate insights. And it looks like ChatGPT's release by Microsoft and OpenAI forced Google's hand to release Bard. And now we have it sort of sitting in our laps. They've dumped these things out there into the public. And there's all these questions about, okay, well, how valuable is this going to be? Or is it just going to do people's homework and let them cheat? What all can we do with this? And what we've been using it for is to kind of back up our research here. And we go out there and find that the hallucinations are creating such a lack of trust in what we're reading that we've sort of stopped using it. It really doesn't get us anywhere. It just makes stuff up and it does it all the time. So anyway, that's early stage, right? Early stage stuff. And certainly, you know, we all think it's going to get better and it
should.
Yeah. Where are they actually using this stuff now that is useful?
Yeah, it's a very interesting, so early days, first off, you know, it will evolve and people will find kind of more and more uses for these type of algorithms. And it is a bit like a general purpose technology, right? Like a PC is a general purpose technology. You can use it for accounting purposes, to write papers, to, do web search, whatever it is. It can serve multiple purposes. And it's the same thing with AI and this specific type of algorithms. I think the way they're being used, first and foremost, for now, is maybe threefold. So first is, it's not accidental that these things were developed by search engines fundamentally, right? So in a way, the one thing they started doing is changing the web browsing experience, right? So we search the web for a variety of reasons. For we just want to get informed about something, or we want to do some research such that we can extract some insights and then write a paper, for instance. And what these algorithms are allowing us to do is to kind of merge all these different steps of a workflow, say, and actually skip those steps and do it themselves and just come up with an answer at the end. So fundamentally, we can start thinking, or at least I started thinking of them as a different way to search the web, as long as along with other information sources, because it's not just the web that they're using for training purposes. They do use papers, books, etc. So it's just a way to distill information for whatever purpose I have in mind. So that's one way. I think certainly OpenAI right now is also started to monetize that same algorithm, the ChatGPT, beyond whatever is it that they do for free with 3.5 on the web search bit, and they do that by basically allowing corporations to come in and actually fine tune the algorithm to their specific purpose, which usually entails. So in your case, for instance, you were saying that you were doing it for, so you were using it for research purposes, but you were not really trusting the results. So that is mostly because the corpus or the body of text in which those algorithms were trained is not specific enough. And basically the research you're looking for is just like a little niche in, the whole universe of text that these algorithms were trained in. So fine tuning is about kind of narrowing down a little bit that domain, like the scope of text in which an algorithm is trained. And they charge for that. So basically, I'm a business. I'm an investment bank, or I'm a fund. I need to fine tune that the research aspect of the algorithm. So I basically feed the algorithm my own corpus of text and can fine tune and calibrate whichever weights are being used to that specific purpose. So it makes for a more bespoken, customized, or targeted, if you like, type of answers. And they do charge for that. So that's it's already being monetized.
So when they're doing it, in other words, if I wanted them to take our books, all 400 podcasts, all the blogs, everything we've ever done in the last, 10 years, 15 years, and I would hire them in effect at OpenAI to create a scope of work that is very much oriented toward what we do.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes. Yes. Whether they, I know they have an API, so a way for, say, an external user to communicate and basically do that fine tuning. I don't know exactly how to, which parameters are needed and how it actually works, but it would be possible that the only thing you have is an API. So you would need somebody to help you with that process of fine tuning, or it could be that OpenAI actually do it themselves. Gotcha. So it goes beyond just having an API, it goes into actually providing a service. But yeah, it is possible to make it a bit more, custom.
Does that mean then that this version that's out for anybody to use on the internet is, like I've described it, as a party trick? Is it just kind of something for people to try and—
Kind of a demo?
Kind of a demo, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a demo. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, as I said earlier, it does change, right? Some people may drop the whole conventional web browsing completely, right? And let's just use ChatGPT, period.
Well, ChatGPT doesn't browse the web, though.
Well, it does, actually. Well, sorry, not real time, no. There's a cutoff, yes, correct. There's a cutoff.
We think maybe Bard is... We weren't sure if Bard is browsing the web or not. It was a little confusing. But I'm sure the idea in the future is for people to be able to put in these more natural language queries and get a good Google search back.
So, well, it will never be real time, right? Because the training is it's something that needs to end. So these algorithms are fed text, they are trained, and then they remain trained. So they don't change real time. So there will always need to be a cutoff, always, even if it's the day before. But there's always a cutoff. So the real time aspect, I don't think that ever is going to be possible to achieve. But you know, to the extent that my web search does not necessarily require kind of real time or super up to date, information, I can still use it as a replacement for the conventional browsing.
Yeah. It could get us SEC info from last month instead of from 2021, like ChatGPT.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So you said there were three types. And so first one is the one that's out there. The second one is businesses hiring, licensing the API. And then was there a third?
Well, I would bundle the third as everyone using it for the specific purpose that use web browsing as an input, but not, the end in itself. A student writing a paper I'm writing a newsletter and I can actually do all that through ChatGPT.
And have it do it for you, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I meant by kind of automating workflows, right? So it sounds very conceptual, but it's basically if I go online because I want to research a company and I want to create a view on, is it a good or bad company so that I can write a paper, let's say three steps, I can actually do that through ChatGPT. I mean, it doesn't mean it's super accurate, right, necessarily, but I can, task ChatGPT for doing all those three things.
It could be completely wrong, could be completely made up. It would produce several paragraphs.
Yes, something, yeah. Now, whether you're comfortable enough to, let out in the world without any human oversight, that's a different topic. But yeah, you could, yeah.
Well, to what extent do you think this... I mean, Google said publicly that they were hitting the red panic button when ChatGPT came out. There was all hands on deck. They have gotten way ahead of us. And we've heard from higher ups in Google just very privately that they feel like they're actually really in trouble to a certain degree. But their public face is, hey, we've got this and we've got the best engineers and anyone who's going to figure it out will be the ones that figure it out. And we've, I just wonder if this is really replacing web browsing ultimately when they stop the hallucinations and it replaces web browsing, what happens to the best business in the world? Arguably the best business in the world. Does it collapse? There's no more ad revenue. It's just gone.
Yeah, and that's a really important point right there, because right now it's an ad-based business, right? So if I want to have my name, my company's name as on top of that search list, I need to pay. And by the way, Bard does have that difference vis-a-vis ChatGPT in that it does seem to identify sources and kind of make them visible and I think the purpose of the visibility or transparency on which sources were used is exactly still enabling that ad-based business, right? Because the moment you actually have names of companies, then you can charge for that. Whereas as far as I haven't really seen ChatGPT 4, but certainly a 3.5, as far as kind of pure browsing as a tool for browsing, it doesn't really say much in ways of sources. So I think there might be a slightly different angle, that Google will need to have on their GPT type of functionality there versus Microsoft.
Interesting. Yeah.
But why is this a big deal? Why are we talking about this? Like, why does anybody care?
I agree.
Okay, it's a revolution in search, maybe. It lets people, students, have a computer write a paper. That could be a big deal. But why are countries worried about it? Why are people talking like we're about to get taken over by the AI machine?
Yeah, literally just read an article yesterday where reasonable people are very concerned that this thing, if allowed to just go on, will ultimately find a way to become a pandemic or worse than a pandemic impact on humanity, which I'm not sure I followed the logic there, but yeah. So.
Yeah. Why? Yeah. I think there's an emotional response to it and there's a rational response. So I think the emotional response is really about up until now, there's a lot of AI that has been deployed, or some AI, let's say, that has been deployed in the corporate world, and people have, you know, at least indirectly been exposed to. But the key word there is indirectly. So there's always a human, or usually there's a human that basically is between what a machine is, you know, telling your organization to do and what is actually ultimately proposed or done with your client. So they've been shielded, if you like, from the AI bit. In this one instance, there's no shield. You know, you are talking to a machine. So I think there's that shock of and a machine that sounds a lot like a human, and that's a little bit the trigger for the emotional reaction, right? Because we, risk in our brains have like an interesting way of interpreting risk. But you know, and the key driver of, you know, high versus low is how quickly we can actually bring something from memory onto, you know, present consciousness. And of course, we all remember movies very easily from, like, you know, apocalyptic movies of machines taking over. So I think there's an overly emphasized version, it's like a perception of risk associated with machines acting like humans. And that's a little bit the irrational bit, if you like. Now, there are, you know, rational, concrete, you know, and valid rational reasons why we need to be careful with these things, you know, because if, some people would argue, for instance, you can use ChatGPT to create malware, like to just create virus, for instance. So there's the ethical use of, you know, a pretty powerful technology that should definitely be considered. There's obviously misinformation and biases that can be, you know, depending on the training data, can be carried over onto kind of a very large chunk of the population. So there are concrete kind of rational risks that we need to be, you know, aware and obviously, you know, eventually prevent and monitor and prevent. But yeah, so there's a few handful of rational reasons, and then I think there's a very large, like, irrational one driving that fear.
You mentioned training data, and I know from talking to you that that is extremely dispositive as to how a machine learning algorithm works and whether it works. Can you just talk more about that for people who don't really know what this training data is, including me?
So training data, I'll try not to get overly technical about this, but, you know, basically training data are just like the set of observations we pass on to an algorithm that learns and identifies certain patterns. So let me give you a concrete example, which is not kind of ChatGPT related, right? But let's say that I'm creating an algorithm that will predict whether a client will leave a bank or, you know, any organization as a client in a certain, you know, period of time. So the training data that I feed into these model would be, you know, certain observations around the client behavior. And most importantly, how does client that, you know, current or observed client behavior change vis-a-vis a certain baseline, right? So I'm just looking at certain patterns on what is the client doing differently? And then what the algorithm does is picks up those.
This is like statistical data from the past that you're talking about, or data from one particular given client?
Well, it's individual at client level. In this case, would be individual clients have their own behaviors, so we're looking at that. But it's past. It's always past behavior we're looking at. But then what the algorithms are incredibly capable of, you know, are competent in doing is identifying those behavioral patterns that can actually be associated with an outcome. In this case, the client leaving the bank or not, right? So you need to discriminate between both. And he can do it with, you know, incredibly high degrees of accuracy and considering a multitude, like a very high set of behaviors in terms of number, and which is something that our brains cannot really kind of get our hands around. So that's why.
And it does that from the data that you gave.
I feed. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's the part that you keep saying to me when I've been talking to you about this stuff is like that, you know, you or person X who's making this, what do you call it? A model?
So let me just clear, because and this is what sometimes I guess might go unnoticed, but there are, when we talk about machine learning algorithms, actually it's a reference to the algorithm that learns from the data. Now the algorithm that learns from the data is learning to create a predictive model, which is another algorithm actually that is the end product of that. And that's why, I mean, when we talk about cutoffs, is because, like earlier, we talked about cutoffs, you know, having to have, you know, in terms of training data, a cutoff. And that's because once the algorithm is trained and there's an algorithm to do the training, then you have a second algorithm, which is actually the predictive model, which is stable. It's static. Mm-hmm. It's always, it doesn't really change necessarily. I mean, there are one instance where it does in a modality of, you know, say machine learning is called reinforcement learning, but let's park that, doesn't really matter. But for the most part, they're static, you know, algorithms. So the, you know, presented with the same input, the prediction will always be the same, never ever change. But it's a training algorithm that we're talking about usually, you know, and that's the one where you feed training data. You also, you know, if we are to get just slightly more detailed, you actually divide the data between a training set and a test set. So what you do with the training is basically have the algorithm identify those patterns and associate certain patterns observed in the data with an outcome. And then you do something called cross-validation. Again, let's not get overly technical, but you then use that algorithm, that predictive model, which you just created, and run it on the test data and basically look at what the predictions were would be when presented with the test data. Now, the interesting thing with this process is that these are behaviors in this case that the algorithm has never seen before. So it's actually testing the ability of the algorithm to generalize on, you know, completely fresh and ever seen, you know, set of data. And that's how we actually assess the accuracy of the final predictive model. So we always know how accurate, you know, in prediction problems, but we always know how accurate an algorithm is before we deploy it out into the world.
So when people are looking at something that they have access to, like a ChatGPT or a Bard, I think the important piece of info is that what matters is the data that's been fed into it. Is that right?
Yes. I think there's two things. So absolutely right. So one thing is basically these generative algorithms, they're trained with the web plus documents, right? Let's oversimplify things a little bit. And what they do actually, when I say the only thing, there are literally trillions of mathematical operations to come up with one word, but the only thing they do is to predict what's the next word that I should put into the sentence, considering that the previous one was that one, and maybe there's even longer memory, you know, the last two or last three words in that sentence were what they were.
These are the generative language.
Yes, the models, generative
just
language.
Just to be clear, not all machine learning does
No. So in that sense, the next word that I, as an algorithm, I'm predicting is very much a function of how many times actually have I observed that word being preceded by the word that I just predicted, you know, before. And that is a function of the text or the training data that I have been, you know, exposed to as an algorithm. So it massively, you know, influences the result, also because it's very domain specific, right? So, you know, a certain word, I don't think water, might happen to follow the word open, right, with different ways depending on the context. Like if we're talking about diving, then open water, yeah, water after open will show up like many, many times. If we're talking about, I don't know, an engineering context or domain, probably hardly ever, you know, the word water after would show up after open. So this brings us to like the first step that I, or the second thing that I think is super important, which is really to understand the prompt, understand the question or the task that I'm being asked. So interpret that question such that I can actually understand. It's not the only thing to understand, but oversimplifying, let's say, decide which domain should I actually be looking at in a more privileged fashion in order to see which word should come after, you know, the one I predicted. So I'm
Is the fear then maybe coming from, it's not happening yet, but eventually that this algorithm, this model would have, its training data would be everything online, like everything connected, satellites, military stuff, you know, is this where maybe people are starting to get these thoughts of these computers might like take over the government and we don't even, maybe it's happened already and we don't even know it, you know? Like, I guess what I'm getting at is you're saying it's not that big of a deal, but smart people are saying it's a big deal, and I'm just trying to understand why. So could it be that the data eventually would just be everything?
Well, so first off, access to data is not completely open to all sources. So there will always be restrictions, right, in terms of what these algorithms can actually have access to. So government data, or you know, on defense, it's hardly unlikely that algorithms will ever be presented with that type of text, you know, data. So I think there's restrictions apply, right, when it comes to what they're actually fed. So I don't necessarily see that as a source of fear in that, you know, now these algorithms are presented with every single text, you know, or corpus that was ever written in the world, that is digitized, obviously, and as such, you know, are the masters of the universe. I don't think that will ever happen, out of the fact that there will always be sensitive data that is not out there and can be used for training purposes.
What about the fear people have that they're going to lose their jobs to this?
Yes,
thing?
Yes, job displacement.
Particularly white collar workers. I'm thinking places where, if they restricted the amount of misinformation that's coming through it, right, by having a more focused data set, as you said, then I would think paralegals to some degree, any lawyer may be, you know, a law firm with 100 people in it might be able to do the same job with 20, or you know, other kinds of white collar work, which is sifting paper, and a necessary job, somebody's got to do it, but all of a sudden could that be eliminated? I mean, how dangerous is that? And I mean, in your work, where you guys consult to some of the biggest companies in the world, what do you see them doing with this stuff that could cause a loss of jobs?
Yeah, so I think that, so the general thinking today is that these algorithms are there to augment, to help the person rather than replace the person. I mean, usually a job or a function, a role, right? It's a combination of many, many different, you know, tasks, not just one thing. Somebody doesn't just perform one task. And I think, you know, these algorithms tend to be granular enough that they might cover, you know, a third, or, and it's already too much, by the way, but like a little fraction of what you do as a professional. And in that sense, they're actually perceived and seen more as, you know, another team member that's kind of helping you out with, you know, certain part of your tasks, rather than a full-on replacement. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, your role is like so granular, right, that, you know, in that one particular tests that you perform might actually be taken over by an algorithm. But more often than not, jobs and roles have a multitude of tasks, and only a subset of those might actually be replaced. And as such, these things are more of a help. Also because, by the way, perception-wise in the corporate world is that those tasks that can feasibly be taken over by an algorithm, they also tend to be slightly less value added. I don't agree with that necessarily, but it's certainly true that many of these algorithms can actually just help automate or facilitate simple enough tasks. I'm actually doing a bit of not doing enough justice with the algorithm. They can actually spot things that humans cannot. But to the extent that they are used for efficiency purposes, business purposes, then yes, some of those tests are just less value-added.
You don't think you would see a real consolidation in white collar work in the near future? You wouldn't be looking for that. I mean, I'm just thinking of what I saw back in the late 1970s as companies were able to computerize a lot of their accounting things. They essentially reduced the number of bookkeepers by an order of magnitude, and those jobs, there were still bookkeepers, but they're one tenth the number of bookkeepers, right? And I'm also thinking other times when there's been a huge technological shifts. I'm thinking of farming, for example, which used to, in America in the 1800s, some 85-90% of the population was engaged in farming. Today, it's like, I think it's under 2%. Yeah. So you've seen this all generated by higher and higher degrees of technology, which start off augmenting somebody's job, but gradually that augmentation, it starts to be realized by a big company. It's like, oh, well, it augmented it by 15%. That's 15% less headcount we need to get the job done. So I would think if this stuff is really actually useful, you're going to see it hit white collar.
It is possible. I would say, maybe like stepping back for a second. I think it will depend a little bit on the industry we're talking about. Is it a service industry versus not? And whether we're talking about kind of front or client-facing people versus middle office or back office types.
Let's just say for fun, software development.
Yeah.
Since that seems to be one area where I've watched a YouTube video, of course, who knows, right? But I watched a YouTube video where I think I saw a guy use ChatGPT to write code and in a very, very short a time just, it essentially reduced the amount of time he had to spend figuring out how to make this formula work in a back test. It was amazing how quickly it could happen.
Yeah.
Just saying, give me the code for X and boom, on the screen it goes,
Yeah. But I mean, let's take that as an example, right? So I think so what you observed, of course, is an example of an augmentation rather than a replacement, right? Because the guy was coding and had a problem with a subset of that code. And then, that was an example of augmentation. Now, let's say that the algorithm evolves to a point where you can write all code. Every single line of code is actually produced by an algorithm. Even then, that guy's job would not have been completely gone, right? Because before you start writing code, and again, I'm not a software person at all, so I have general knowledge of what software development entails, but I do know it does entail kind of a translation of defining certain business requirements, translating that onto, here's what the software piece needs to do, and those two steps, and then code, right? So those two steps, that person will still need to do them, before you actually instruct. True. Yeah. So in a way, it's kind of, again, in this particular example, is transferring the person's attention, the human's attention, to a different set of activities that are still part of the role, and are, in that case, a bit more, I would say, value adding, right? Because that, the first two steps are all about setting direction. The third step, like the code production, is just literally churn out code and get the software done. So it, I think it would still be a bit of an augmentation exercise. But you're right in that, I mean, it's certainly true. I mean, we don't need to go as far back as Industrial Revolution. You know? Certainly not the PC as a general purpose technology has done, you know, a bit of that also. But job displacement will always be a bit of a topic. Because, you know, it's certainly true that, you know, even in that example, if you have three or four coders and now actually they only have from a full FTE, right, so a full-time equivalent, they're actually only, you know, using, I don't know, 50%, right? You end up only needing two, actually, because the other guy can be taken off because the other two would make for a full-time equivalent person. So, yeah, you could still save up some capacity in that particular example.
So, what other things cause a fear? I mean, or do you see that at all where you're working with the machine learning? Or is it more like the people you're working with are like, give me this now. I want this. This is great stuff.
Well, so it's very interesting, actually, because I'm certain that most of the people I work with, they don't care about machine learning or artificial intelligence per se. What they do care is about solving a problem, mm-hmm. you know, and machine learning is really just a tool in helping solve that problem. And it operates in two ways, fundamentally. One is it can create transparency on a specific problem that it wouldn't be possible otherwise. You know, let's say I'm developing a new offer for a bank. So rather than just, you know, kind of guesstimating what the features of that offer should be, I actually use machine learning to understand, you know, how clients behave and how they consume that and other solutions, and then use that information to identify needs, and then I pick up those needs, and that's what I design for. Basically, I design a proposition to address those specific needs. So in this case, or in this instance, machine learning was used just to create transparency that then informed the design of that offer. And another way in which can create
also slightly more reliable predictions, right?
Well, in this case, there's no prediction. There's just, hey, you might not be aware of the different client types you have based on how they actually use you as a service provider. So let us create transparency on that. And then, and by doing so, you can identify those client types that are either strategically or materially more relevant going forward and use those and their underlying needs as the basis for, okay, now I'm going to put together or tailor, if you like, a proposition.
So
to
then
address,
the business decision then is based on the business strategy is then based
on that transparency. Exactly. Okay. So in that instance, you know, machine learning was just used for transparency. It didn't tell me what the solution should be, i.e. what the design should be. It just told me, hey, you know, just factor in the needs of these two or three, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter, client types. The second way in which, you know, machine learning can be used in a business, or I've been using machine learning in a business context, is, and here, yes, there are predictions, basically, is a way to point me to, or when I say me, not necessarily me, but my clients, in terms of what's the right course of action. Now, let's say, for instance, I mean, we mentioned, you know, clients at risk. So basically clients that are dissatisfied with a bank and through their behaviors which are visible in the data, right, are kind of telling us that things are not so good. And those behaviors might actually, so to say, the relationship manager or the person managing that client might not actually be aware of that. So in this instance, we're actually using algorithms to make predictions on, here's a client that has an 83% chance of leaving the bank in 3 months' time. So you should definitely go and talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, we can even use the algorithm to also pinpoint what the most likely reasons for that level of risk are. And basically, then it's up to the person to take up that information and then actually call the client and do something about retaining the client, if that's the will of the organization. So like every single client at risk should be retained at all. Mm-hmm. But if worthwhile retaining, then yeah, that's how it's done. And in this case, these algorithms were we're basically making predictions. I mean, other types of predictions could be on pricing. I mean, I have in the past created algorithms that predict the client's willingness to pay for a specific product or service. Algorithms can be used to cross-sell or upsell products, basically identifying clients that are more likely to buy into a different product or service that they may not have done yet. So these are all kind of prediction problems that we also can use algorithms for. What I would say is that the target group and the type of algorithms are, these two types are a little bit different. So the first type we talked, basically algorithms that are there to create transparency on a specific pain point or problem, such that it can be addressed in a more effective way. Though the stakeholder group for those types are usually kind of C-suite manager people, right? So people that are making structural decisions, longer term decisions that affect an organization structurally. And those algorithms also have a particularity in that they are one-offs, right? We use it in the context of the project we're doing. Once it's done, when it serves its purpose, it's gone. It disappears because the decision has been made. Now there's a new proposition, or there's a new a portfolio of markets we go after, or there's a new segmentation scheme in place that the algorithms help us put together. But once that is done, it's done. The algorithm is gone. It disappears. It goes up into the ether. Now the second type are algorithms that are used for recurring purposes, right? Because there will always be clients that grow dissatisfaction, right? Or growing their dissatisfaction. So there will always be new clients at risk. So basically these are algorithms that actually need to use, recurrently. And again, the stakeholder group on these are a little bit different. So these are people that are making everyday decisions about clients, about, products, about, pricing, you name it. So those are like two different types of algorithms and also stakeholder groups.
Well, this has been incredible, and we're running a bit long, so I think maybe we should come back, if we can get you, next week and talk about how this actually applies to investing practice and investing research. But what I've taken is that, I mean, everything you just said about how an individual company might use machine learning is that it's giving them better information, perhaps predictions that they wouldn't have otherwise had or that they were guesstimating, and they do that by feeding in what you said, the training data, or whoever's creating the model is feeding in that training data, choosing what to tell it. And then after it's all done, then it's again humans making business decisions,
yes,
from that information, which to me is just great. Like, it's not scary or crazy or filled with money hungry, power hungry, bloodthirsty, warmongering computers. So I don't know. I'm just missing whatever this terrifying part of it is, which maybe is correct? Question mark.
I completely agree. I don't share that risk kind of perception at all. And I do find these things to be incredibly useful, in that we all have biases and heuristics and blind spots. We do. And for me personally, a big role of particularly the tactical algorithms we talked about is really about helping us fill in those blind spots. And again, just coming back to the example of attrition is a really good one, because
attrition, meaning clients potentially leaving a business.
Client churn. Because usually, and again, in my particular area or my clients, which are wealth managers for the most part, clients will not speak up until it's too late. So they will not raise their hand and say, hey, I'm not happy with something you have done or you have not done. They really don't do that. By the time they raise their hand, all the goodwill is gone. And the client will leave for sure. There's no retention measure that will hold the client in place. But what clients do is they do try to resolve the situation. So their behaviors change to the extent that they're trying to change something in that relationship. And those are the exact same set of behaviors that these algorithms can then use to discriminate between clients that are at risk versus ones that are not at risk. So clients do communicate a lot with their, you know, providers of any something, you know, product, service, doesn't really matter, but just in a non-verbal, in a tacit, way. And these algorithms are really very powerful in capturing that communication and basically making it usable for the human to actually do something with it. And in the process, of course, kind of offsetting those you know, the blind spots. We all have
quantified behavioral economics.
Yeah. Yes, through data. Yeah.
Well, what I want to know is how can I, as an investor on my couch, use this stuff for my own benefit? Two, how can I find out or discover companies that are entering this new world in a good way? In a good way, that means nothing. In a way that's benefiting the business, to build new business, to build their company, to streamline, to whatever. Those are the two things I'm interested in. Dad?
Yep, I think that is... that's going to sum it up for me too. I think really I'd love to dive into that more, Nunes. If you can give us a little bit more time, that'd be fabulous.
Absolutely. More than happy to.
All right, man. That would be great. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot. And look forward to seeing you again, Nuno.
Thanks, likewise, everybody. Though. And thank you, Nuno, for joining us.
Welcome. Most welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi guys, thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding, they really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it's really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor. Nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.